This is RSVNB Update, episode 609, recorded Thursday, March 9th, 2017, Out of the Closet. Hello, everybody, and thank you for joining us for another episode of RSBNB Update. Your wonderful hosts are here, Shane12088 and Sirion.
I don't have numbers behind my name.
No, and that's good, because numbers make it harder for you to be found in the RuneScape high scores. So, very smart of you not to put numbers in your name. Sirion, 1234, something, something, something. Maybe in the future. For an Iron Man character, I don't know. Sirion the second.
I have plenty of good ideas for names for Iron Man characters, but I'm not going to share them because I don't want people to steal them.
Yeah, that's right. I was just going to say maybe your name's spelled backwards, since that seems to be a Clan Quest thing to do.
I don't really consider that, to be honest.
Anyways, this week on RSBNB Update, we do have the Lumbridge Crater rework, which was a game jam update. It was a while before we expected we would see something like this, but oh, JX actually wanted to proceed forward with this. So we got a nice graphical reclamation of the Lumbridge Crater. Keeping in mind it's been almost 4 years since World Event Number 1 that completely changed that area and, you know, turned it from what was, I guess, just north of the Lumbridge Swamp with some skilling areas that were there, like the farming tree patch, to just a crater that, you know, really appeared barren and desolate for the last 4 years or so. Nice that they finally changed this, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it's still recognizable as something happened there. It's still the circle, and yeah, but if you're a new player, it now also doesn't feel that much like you missed something.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a beehive in the tree. I'm just looking over some of the video here. There's a beehive hanging from one of the trees. That was interesting. They also removed the plinths for the Ceridoman and Zamorak encampments that were there. So those will no longer tower in the sky. But a fun little thing this week is that if you went to the Zamorak encampment, there were force walk tiles and force teleport tiles still there from where the encampment was residing. So that was a fun little thing to stumble upon when we were exploring the area around the crater. Also, they removed the Cabbage Face Punch Bonanza game to the Gamer's Grotto. I don't think anyone's going to be too worried about that because, I mean, when was the last time we seriously played that game?
I think I've played it once.
Yeah.
Ever.
Probably for the spring event that was happening there, right?
Not even.
Yeah. But, you know, they aim to have this area be a gathering, a community gathering area, a place for skilling and whatnot. And they did actually put a bank chest in there, so they would like to see some portable use or maybe even some divine locations. So I think Jagex is spot on the mark with that, because right now I think the two major gathering areas in-game are the two Grand Exchanges and, to a lesser extent, Berthorf, where the portable action happens at reset, as well as
the Combat Academy in Lumbridge was also used for portables, especially during bonus XP weekends.
Okay.
So I'm sort of expecting to see that club at least sort of moving to the crater, maybe, because there's just more room.
Yeah, and it's a natural
move
for
them. But I guess we'll have to see what the community adapts. I mean, it's sort of like communities don't really change if there's no reason to change.
Yep.
So we'll have to see if it actually gets adapted. But the opportunity is definitely there.
Yeah, and I mean, it's a huge wide open area and with a bank chest there. And I haven't seen anyone there yet, so we'll just have to wait and see what the general use case is for this. But you know, there's a nice little lake in the center where the hole was initially, where it came up out of the ground. So I mean, it is a pretty nice looking area compared to other areas that you could choose to gather at RS. So I do hope people will come there and utilize it. So
yeah, and once again, they also updated the textures of that area,
right,
and the areas immediately around it. So pretty much everything between the River Lum and basically the Divination Camp on the other side has been made into like new textures. Something that was sort of disappointing is that the cutoff into, say, the swamp or like the trainer area is just, it's just a straight line. It's really obvious.
Mm.
They definitely probably want to like slowly roll out these new textures across the world. So yeah. I'm not too worried about it. It's just,
I mean, it looks great like it is, and the ground textures aren't something that you immediately notice unless you're looking for it. It blends in, you know, just as is. So,
if you try going south to the swamp, like all of a sudden there's just a hard cut in on the ground,
right?
In terms of like ground texture, which is to be expected, but it's not particularly nice. You can definitely see what sort of bounce are where they apply to new texture.
Yeah.
But it's a start, and I'm going to assume that maybe just like they did with the trees, the new style of trees, that maybe one day they'll just change everything in one go, or maybe they will keep going and do smaller areas at a time.
Yeah. And, you know, speaking of trees, there's actually two yellow trees inside the crater for some reason. All the other trees are the standard green, so that was a little bit odd to see. It's like they look diseased or something, or have the wrong kind of lighting on them. Wondering if that's intentional or if that's a bug, because there's only two of them that do that. So, but I don't know. Very nice, and I think I'll be using that as one of my other go-to areas aside from Prif, because, you know, well, it's nice to have the Grand Exchange and everything right there. I sometimes just like to get away from the areas that people tend to congregate around. And, you know, one of the areas I have used in the past has been the Catherby Bank. And this will just be another good one to stop because it's close to all the farming patches. So overall, mm-hmm. I'm very happy with this. And I like what Jagex did with it. So well done. And I can't wait to see more of these graphical changes like this in game. All right, so also this week we do have the wardrobe rework coming out of Game Jam, and you know, I think that this is the most impactful update of the week based on what I was chatting with people about. Just because it changes so many things and makes the wardrobe a lot more easy to use, and I think really shows where Jagex is going with their interface design. So, that's my thoughts on it. You have a chance to have a look at it?
Yeah, so I haven't really any big makeovers planned. I just changed my outfit a few weeks ago. But, I mean, it's like, I know the old interface, you had to sort of click to every
right
thing to actually see what it is.
Yeah.
And it's going to be a lot easier now to just look through your stuff and see if there's something nice there without having to click through everything or go by name. And I feel the interface is still slow. Like you load like a new page and it takes a while for the outfit to show up.
Yeah, because it's like dynamically generating the previews of your character, which seems slower than it should be.
It doesn't feel as snappy as it should be.
Yeah.
But then again, when has RuneScape interfaces ever felt snappy?
And when have RuneScape interfaces actually been usable and look good? Like, they're starting to become usable now over the past, you know, 3 years since RS3 came out, and look nice. So they are making progress on that, but I totally get what you mean. You know, when you first open this, you get a nice little tutorial window. It shows what all the icons are for, you know, full outfits, keepsake box, filter by slot, advanced filter, which really lets you drill down into where the outfits are coming from. You can then filter by availability or source. Then there's a grid view and a list view option, as well as a search. So if you have an idea what you're looking for, you can just pop it in. There's an undo button, so you can undo all the changes that you've made. There's a clear all, and you can wipe what you're working on and start fresh. And then there's a nice little legend that shows where you get the current override. So it shows if you have an override currently applied, a preview that can be applied to you, available for purchase on Solomon's store, or unavailable, and you can mouse over for more information. And they also show if you own the item, or if you can buy it from Solomon's Treasure Hunter through a limited dime event, or earn it through in-game activities. So at a glance, you're able to tell where something is from, which you weren't really able to do before. You kind of had to go and look up and see, is this a rune coin item, or is this a loyalty item, or do I need to get lucky on Treasure Hunter kind of thing. So
I do definitely think they improved the usability of the of all the different wardrobe stores, showrooms we have, and all the currencies in the corner. That's really nice, because you also always had to sort of go to the lobby or look into some weird interface to see how many points of each you had and how much you could had to spend. And now the interface has really become a central hub for basically everything that's appearance related, and yep. The game needed that. They have been adding so many new things to the game, and then the interface never really evolved to support that. And I mean, when we first got like graphical overrides, that is where the old interface came from. And when they were like 10 or 20, that was completely doable. But like, we are at the point where everybody's using
Overrides of some sort.
Overrides, yeah, that's the word I was looking for. Like, everybody is using overrides. That's just that's what people have come to accept. And if it's that, if it's a really important part of the game, then it should get the attention it got. And I think this is a good step in making that interface. There's definitely still, the interface is not as snappy as it could be. But maybe that's just something that Jack needs to fix in general. Like, all the interfaces always feel very, I mean, like there's this input lag all the time, and the interaction is never as fluid as you would want to.
Yeah.
But in terms of like the concept, definitely a good start.
Yeah, and then, I mean, if you truly want to, you can go back to list view and you can get a view of exactly what you had before. Grid view offers the dynamic previews of what you're wearing. List view is going to be most like what we had. So if you want the old way, you can do that. And you get even a better experience in doing that. So, it's pretty great. I think one of the things that I'm going to end up probably using most out of this is the advanced, filter, because, you know, you can just totally choose, am I looking for an item for my, you know, for my feet? Am I looking for an item from Treasure Hunter? Am I looking for an item from the loyalty store? You name it. So, you know, I was not expecting this as an option, and to see this as, you know, a quality of life update that came out of Game Jam is something I think that we should all be very proud of and very happy about. Because, I mean, like, there's so many checkboxes you can select here, and you can really just get down to what you're looking for with this advanced filter view. And, you know, I think that's probably the view I'll end up using the most, because you can have your search and you can say, I want to search for only head items, and there you go. Or you can do the advanced filtering as well. So, really pleased with this.
And then, of course, the option to have bare hands and bare feet now.
Yes, of course. We can't forget that. Lots of people will like that, especially for the summer season, I guess. Though, I don't know. I don't know how that would work, running through the God Wars dungeon, the first God Wars dungeon with bare feet, because that'd be pretty cold, wouldn't it?
I've been doing it in slippers for, like, the longest time. It's completely fine.
Okay. You can also purchase more rune coins.
You don't need tops either.
Oh, boy.
Shorts, yeah. Fine.
Yeah, you enjoy running around like that, don't you?
Yeah.
You can also purchase more rune coins and keepsake tokens directly from this interface now. So you basically just click it and you'll have an option to purchase with what you have available. So that's good. And another good thing they did, they reworked the way keepsake keys work, because previously it would be kind of confusing. How do I keepsake this item? You'd have to use the keepsake key on the actual item, right? Now, what you can do to keepsake something is if you have the keepsake key available, it knows, and all you need to do is drag the item from your inventory into the wardrobe menu to keepsake it, and then that will keepsake that item in one of your keepsake slots. So it then just immediately works as an override after that. So that's a nice little streamlining of the material there. Because, I mean, when you think about it in the past, who really would know that you need to use a keepsake key on an item to store it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And even then, getting the item back, you'd have to right-click and choose reclaim. And, I mean, it wasn't necessarily obvious. So this fixes a lot of those issues. And I think within, you know, an overgrowing focus on Fashionscape, that tends to be... where the updates need to happen. So overall, a job well done for Jagex here, I think.
Agreed.
Anything else on the wardrobe rework?
Nope.
Alrighty then. Now we're going to move on to the skilling outfits that have appeared in game this week. So first up, they added the shark outfits to the game. And of course, these are the elite skilling shark outfits, the ones that were... I think the first outfit that we felt was truly overpowered. So at level 70 fishing, you start collecting shark fragments, and the rate will increase, of course, at level 99 and 120. So then you just put them together using the same invention blueprint that you do for all the other items, and you can get a piece of the shark outfit to eventually complete the set. Which I think if you're going for 120 fishing or 200 mil XP or even 99, this is a good thing to work on, because that outfit is... Pretty useful. So I'm glad this one made its way into game.
Yep.
And I think we all know if you ever see a shark running around on World 66, that's got to be Seb from our Clan Quest. I mean, the first time I saw that outfit and saw him with that outfit, it was just absolutely hilarious, because he had his shark outfit and he was running around with a golden cane. So you see a shark running around with a golden cane, it's like, oh, okay. We can do that in RS. That's what Fashionscape is for. As a recap, they give a 5% extra chance of catching fish, removes aggression from the living rock creatures, and inherits the fishing outfit's 5% XP boost, 1% per piece, even while the set is in the bank, tackle box, or player-owned house are destroyed. So, and then you, of course, combine them, and they end up becoming 7% and importing all those same benefits. So definitely something you want to do if you're down there for living rock caverns.
Mm-hmm.
We also got the standard skilling outfits, the non-elite ones coming into game this week. The divination outfit, the cooking outfit, the summoning outfit, and the prayer outfit. The divination outfit you'll get by chance of completing a Guthixia cache. At the end of it, you'll get an outfit piece, potentially. The cooking outfit for completing hard gnome deliveries, you'll have a chance of receiving it. Summoning, a chance of getting it from the summoning supply crates awarded in familiarization. And the prayer outfit pieces can be purchased for ecto tokens from the Shady Ghost, right at the Ecto Functus, for 1,000 ecto tokens in total. How do you feel about the fact that the first three are chance-based and the last one is purely purchase-based?
Yeah, I don't know. I have the feeling they should all work towards a place where you just can just get them.
Yeah.
Like guaranteed. And I mean, 1,000 ecto tokens is quite a lot. But then again, if you use ecto fungus for training, it's not that much.
Yeah. And I mean, I think the hardest one is going to be the gnome mm-hmm. restaurant one, because those deliveries can take a while. And the caches are limited to, I think, two per day?
Yeah, two your per day. Reward ones per day. Yeah.
And familiarization doesn't happen that often either, so kind of time-gated on those compared to the prayer one. So that was a little bit concerning, but I think that for anyone who wants these, it'll be a good way of getting them, because I think they're still going to be on Vic whenever Vic comes around next time. So we'll have to see about that. But that's the Game Jam update, the updates that were worked on at Game Jam this week that ended up coming into game. So nice to see some progress on this. But we're going to move on to the patch notes right now. So first off, there are now going to be news broadcasts for J-Mod spawning the Wilding Worm, which apparently wasn't happening before. I guess you would have had to been in tune when the J-Mod was doing an event in the wilderness for that. I don't know who follows those kind of events, but I guess there are people who would do that. Players can no longer disassemble items worth over 1 million GP in combat. Why do you think they do that?
So, in combat, they can't show you a confirmation dialogue.
Ah, all right. That makes sense. Because it's just one of those interfaces that floats and needs to take your attention away from everything.
Yeah, so I think what happened is in combat, you could just do it, maybe.
Okay.
Either you could just do it, or the interface would just be interrupted all the time. Both are, of course, suboptimal. So I think it makes sense.
Yeah, and I think anytime you get something worth over 1 million and you're in combat, that might be time when you want to take a pause and have a look and see if you really want to do disassemble that item. So, a new cape has been added to the memory of Nomad for completing it within 6 minutes. You know, this is something I wanted to go back to, but I never did. Did you go back for this?
If I'm completely honest, I can't be bothered.
Yeah. You know, like there's so many great things like this after Nomad's Elegy and then the V quest as well for these little questing-based boss encounters that I've wanted to go back to, but I never made it back there. So this has to be like a Master Quest Cape requirement, right? To get the cape, I think.
I don't know if you need to get the best cape, but
okay.
I think you just need to do a kill.
Okay. Yeah, you know, that would make sense because I think the Master Quest cape isn't necessarily one that they want to put too many PVM requirements behind. So, all right. The Lucky perk now functions correctly while wearing the Anima Core Armor of Sliske. Lucky is still disabled if you have selected the Battle of Lumbridge set effect. So the Lucky perk, let's see. Let me remind myself what the Lucky perk does. I think it gives you a chance of doing more damage, right? If I recall. Okay. Lucky invention perk has a 0.5% chance per rank that when hit, the damage dealt will be reduced to 1. So.
Okay. I think that is actually the effect that the... that's actually the effect of Battle of Lumbridge set. Gives.
Okay. All right.
That's well.
Right. Yes, I actually do remember that. I did give a chance of reducing that. So they only want the reduction to happen once.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Fair enough. You can now activate your Magic Skill Cape perk in any banking area, which is, of course, the Skill Cape perk that lets you change spell books. You know, I never got around to having a look at this perk itself, but I'm betting that there were banking boxes and banking chests out there where this didn't work, and it was something that people reported to them, which I think if you're near a bank, it should just work. So that's good. That's been fixed.
Mm-hmm.
Buff icons for combination potions have been updated to be less confusing. I didn't use any combination potions this week, but we'll have to take their word for it. All right. Now, here's something that I think might raise some questions for people, this patch note. We have added bad luck mitigation to some lore drops so that cumulative monster kills shift the drop rate towards 100% once a certain threshold has been reached. This affects drops which have a drop rate of 1 out of 100 or worse. For the last writer's book from the KBD, this does not affect group kills. Players can still gain a kill count from the group fight, but the 100% drop will only occur in a fight on your own. If the threshold has been met, the full list of affected drops are Adamant Dragons, the Dragonkin Journals, not Forsay's Journal, the King Black Dragon, Last Writer's Book, Ripper Demons, for Minor Journals, and the Diary of Jebediah Omnes, and Court Summons, only if you're obtaining via monster kills. Okay, I know people dislike fighting the Ripper Demons and going for the Last Writer's Book, so I think that this is a good update for anyone going for that, but I wonder how people who went for it in the past will feel.
I cannot answer that. I mean, I did all the court court summons, and I had no issue obtaining them.
Right.
To, like, clues and that kind of stuff. It was really easy to get all of them. So that one was definitely not necessary. I have not really gone for the other ones. But we have to realize that, like, people going for these books are generally after the lore and not necessarily after the hardest PVM right. encounters. And while I don't necessarily think this is a bad, like, it's bad to hide them behind monsters, it is bad if you sort of force people to grind hours upon hours just to get a book with a bit of lore. And
right, if it becomes an RNG requirement rather than, you know, just kill a couple, I think.
Yeah. So I would definitely think that this is not a bad update. What do people think that already got it? Well, this is a thing that happens in games. Like, over time, it becomes easier to get things. They halve the number of points requirement for a livid farm. Every skill has become easier to train since its release. Like, everything becomes easier over time, and sure, you can feel salty about that, but on the other hand, it's at that point you took the choice to sacrifice your time in getting a book, and, well, now you don't.
Yeah. And, I mean, I think you made a good point. You know, the only people we're going to hear this from are those who are salty about it. And I think, in general, you hit the nail on the head, especially with MMOs, that over time things become easier. And I think it tends to be a general strategy that when you're building an MMO, it's better to buff than to nerf things down. And by buffing things all over time, what was initially unobtainable 2 years ago and then was only obtainable by, you know, 5% of the population will now be obtainable by, say, maybe 50% of the population. So I think that that is a constant thing that we have with MMOs. And anyone who thinks otherwise needs to look at other MMOs and realize, I think, that we got it pretty good here in RuneScape. So,
I mean, it's a sliding window thing, right? So, if you are if you get a new drop, like, let's say they release a new weapon drop, like, if you get that, and the first few weeks you'll be pretty awesome, and it will be pretty unique to get it. But over time, more and more people are going to get it, and then on the longer scale, new armor is going to come out. People are going to have it easier to kill the boss. That drops that new weapon, and over time it becomes more common. And there is a reason behind this. It's not that this is part of the design, is what I'm trying to say, because you don't want somebody to invest some time, get a unique item, and then be awesome forever. Like, you want right. this separation of people. If you want to always have this prestige of having new stuff, you need to do continuous investments. And that's what I meant with the sliding window. Like, there's new things coming out all the time. And if you want to be ahead of the pack, you have to stay ahead of the pack and not just stop and be awesome. Like, that's the whole point here. And that means people can be overtaken in some sort of way. It means that if one person has, like, all these unique items, that they can never be overtaken anymore. This is right. sort of a way to keep the game moving, and that is something we have to accept. That's part of what an MMO is, and that's part of what any game does that continuously releases new stuff. But yeah, I mean, like, there's so many examples of this. Originally, it was not even considered that people might get 99 in any skill.
Right.
Like, that was inconceivable. That ever happened.
Back in RS Classic, oh boy, you got 99 woodcutting. You were known for endurance.
Yeah, yeah. So we have to realize that the game slowly shifts towards that, which is harder because you need to squeeze in more content if you have these upper limits. And that's why in games like World of Warcraft, you see the level cap increase all the time just to, like, push that further. That's how it works, and if you are salty about this, then I'm sorry, but I mean, this you can still say that you got it before this came out, and that doesn't reduce any of the prestige that you had.
That's true. Your achievement should be your own, and I think that that's a very good way to play RS, and that's how I play it.
Yeah, and there will be new things where you can excel at, and well.
And you know, one thing I would like to say with this is that the Adamant Dragons are, I mean, they're not too bad. But the Ripper Demons have been known for being a Slayer creature where if you don't have a good connection or you lapse out for a few seconds at a key instance, you can die. So, you know, people don't necessarily want to be fighting Ripper Demons for so long. And I think if this list was here and they just said, we're making this change for Ripper Demons, that would have been fine. And I think that's probably how this patch note probably originated. But in looking at the Ripper Demons, they also realized they need to look at the KBD and the Adamant Dragons as well. Well, there we go. That's how we end up with the current content of the patch note. Alrighty. Anything else left in the patch notes this week that you'd like to mention?
Nope. I think we covered all the interesting ones.
Yep. Okie dokes. Alright. So, you know, just as we get the Shark outfit in game, another Elite Skilling outfit. Oh, we got Nature Sentinel, the Elite Woodcutting outfit, has arrived on Treasure Hunter for this weekend. There's three outfits in total, the Oaken Sentinel, the Willow Sentinel, and the Maple Sentinel. Each of them will be available on the first 3 days, and then you need to, after that, combine them into different, or rather, you need to get them from Treasure Hunter because they're going to be all mixed up on the fourth day. So, I think we knew it would only be a matter of time before we'd see another one of these, right?
I'm not surprised at all.
Yeah, same. You know, it's okay, I think, this time around. They aren't hideously overpowered like the Shark outfit or the other ones that have come out. Because with this one, you only get a 5% chance increase to your woodcutting success rate, a 5% chance increase to obtain bird's nest, 5 daily teleports to a selection of woodcutting locations, and an option to automatically burn logs when cut, 25% chance. Then if you combine them all for the Nature Sentinel outfit, that goes up to 7% for each of those, 20 teleports daily, an option to automatically burn or fletch logs when cut, 25% chance still, the ability to contact evil trees, similar to the Easter Crown, and the ability to place one miniature evil tree per day that will scale with your level and works like a divine location but doesn't count against your cap. You know, these don't really seem too bad, and they also get the benefit of the lumberjack clothing if you have it. So,
sounds like a good boost if you're going for that woodcutting experience, but
It's not something that you absolutely need, right?
No.
Like the Shark outfit, for example. There's nothing, I think, too overpowered here. And if I had to wager a guess, I'd say that Jagex has listened to the community here in terms of figuring out what they do and do not like on these kinds of updates. So, overall, I have no complaints with this. I think the only way to have a real complaint about this is if you're against Treasure Hunter updates in general here. So, I don't think there's much to be said here, unless there's anything else you'd like to pull up on this.
Not really.
Yeah. I already got one of the pieces. I'd like to get more. I'd like to complete at least one set before the weekend goes away, so we'll be aiming for 5 in total over the weekend, though I don't know how realistic that will be, considering most of my daily challenges are ones that I don't want to do. So, are you going to go for the outfit?
I'm going to try and use my spins every day, but I'm usually unlucky with these outfits. So, I mean, I still haven't gotten my full Shark outfit.
Right.
So,
well, you can go fishing and you can get started on that right now.
Yeah, I could. I should probably do that, but yeah.
I mean, there's lots of other things to do, but anyways, Actually, there is one thing I'd like to bring into the patch notes that I did not put in the notes, but I realized was happening and was brought out to everyone. If you go into your RuneScape settings on the website and you opt into receiving emails from them, the promotional emails, and just basically let them contact you at your email address, at the end of every month, you know, plus or minus a week, you will receive an email for your stats for the previous month. So I got my stats for February. I gained 4 levels and 1 quest point and a small amount of XP, I'm sure, compared to everyone else out there. So this is a nice way of, you know, keeping players on tab of what they've been up to. I don't know if you got an email like this, but I got mine yesterday.
I got my email, but I don't know. It doesn't add that much value for me, so I'm probably going to disable them. I get enough emails as this.
Yeah. I mean, if people want this, there are a lot better solutions out there for this, like the RSBNB high scores, for example, and any number of...
Oh, nice plug.
Yeah, and any other number of high scores tools out there. I think ours are the best, though. Alrighty, they do have a merchant store offer on until March 16th, so for a week, if you spend more than £15 or $20 or €20, you will receive free shipping from the Jagex merchandise store. So they brought this in with a promotion for their new hardcore Iron Man design, which includes, you know, t-shirts and hoodies and whatnot, if you wanted to do such a thing. So if you've also been eyeing up that Gnome Child t-shirt, that would be a time to purchase that. So I don't know, nothing really in the store ever stood out for me. Anything for you?
Not really. I'm probably one of these people that would also not really wear it in public. I'm not out, if that's how you want to call it. But
you're not out?
Oh, like, I don't share publicly in my normal life that I'm a big RuneScape fan, so...
Oh, okay. That's an interesting way of putting it.
Yeah, that's how we were talking about it on Octane Quest Chat last week, so... Or this week.
Wow. All right.
Yeah.
I mean, there's also the hats, and there's the toque, and there's the Rune Mage sweater. Yeah, you know, I don't think you'd want to wear that.
I don't think you want to be seen in those in general, probably. Yeah. Is that the point?
Yeah, definitely not the Rune Mage one. So. All righty. Well... there is a, you know, a Pack Yak plushie, which, I mean...
Oh, that might be quite cute, yeah.
Yeah, but, I mean, $40 Canadian, that's a lot.
Yeah.
And I don't think it shows how large it is either. Oh, it does. 36 centimeters by 20 centimeters by 22 centimeters, so it's pretty large.
But, yeah,
there's options for that. Anyways... also, we do have the month ahead for March that was posted this week. So, what do we got here? The luck rework is going to be coming this month, which is, of course, Mod Timbo's project. That'll be interesting when it arrives, I think, seeing as luck hasn't been reworked for a long time in this game with the Ring of Wealth and whatnot. I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, definitely going to be interesting to see, because the Ring of Wealth is... not going to be useful at all anymore at many things. So we'll have to see what's going to happen with it and with the other items.
Yeah. Also changes to the Ark, including extra features for the Aaliyah Crablets and the Ark Journal, alongside with the all-important addition of new rewards like the High Armor of Honto and its related weapons. Okay, that might be interesting, because that could give a, you know, kind of a complete feeling to the Ark, because I think the Ark kind of feels like, okay, you go there once and you finish it and then you're done. So let's see if that changes it.
From what I heard, you need like, what was it, 10,000, 100,000 chimes to like get that reward, and it's going to be a completionist requirement. So better get going and get it up.
That's a lot.
But yeah, it's a lot.
Do we know what the stats are going to be on this armor?
No idea.
All right. They're also going to be bringing forward the game jam changes for splitting out buffs and debuffs on the buff bar down below. So that's good. Adding more of the buff icons and debuff icons that Mod Shawnee was working on during game jam. So there's that. Also the pet interface add-ons that were talked about at game jam for the various pets that are not in the interface currently. And a Zamorakian event. Quote, the Twin Furies are sending their agents back to Gilinar to bring some Zamorakian defectors back to justice. Check out their event shop and in-game skilling opportunities for Zamorakian marks tradable for some fierce cosmetic outfits.
I am personally hoping it's going to be something like the event we had with the Heart of Gilinar and the Falador event, like where there's two skills every day you can work on.
Yeah. Not like
something like
Valentine's
that. Like I like
one,
it,
for example.
Yeah, that was. I don't like because it's quite slow to get them. You have to play a lot, which I don't, and it's there's no way to really focus towards the event. But I guess we'll have to find out.
Yeah, and interesting. They say tradable. So.
Okay.
Yeah. Also, there was some. Linking in the behind-the-scenes video itself that there is going to be a name release and they're going to be releasing more names that are currently dormant and not in use. So if you've ever wanted to, you know, try and change your name to something else, you might be able to pull that off this time. So we're kind of back to what we started this RS segment with. Are you going to change your name to anything else?
No, I mean, they just did a purge in February. We always notice it in our clan ranks because, like, members that have not been around for a long while, their names turn into weird generated strings. I mean, it like, looks like they're doing two purges in, like, in close succession, or maybe they did the purge early and...
And
they already
not
released the video
or something.
So I guess we'll have to find out. But I'm so happy with my name. And I mean, I feel it's important to remain recognizable as well. So I've stuck with my current name ever since I really started doing things with community people.
Yeah. And, you know, that's the same thing I feel as well. That's why I never changed away from mine. So. All right. Well, that's it for RS updates this week. We have no questions this week. So we're just going to jump straight on into tech news. So, you know, tech news can be a mixed bag, I think. It can bring good things and it can bring things that people like seeing. And it also can bring things that people don't like seeing. This week is something that people probably don't like seeing. And, you know, it was really shocking when we saw this and what was inevitably released this week by WikiLeaks. You know, they teased this as saying that the contents of our release tomorrow will be of interest to all tech journalists. And, oh boy, they are. So this Monday, WikiLeaks released something called Vault 7, CIA Hacking Tools Revealed. Now, you might say, okay, so they got some information from the CIA about what they use for hacking tools. How does this affect me? Well, the answer is that they have a collection of malware and can pretty much break any piece of technology that exists today. Vault 7 was the largest ever publication of documents on the CIA that was leaked.
So is it just malware? Because I had the impression that it was a lot of zero-day bugs, like zero-day... Yeah,
it was zero-day bugs, but there were also the hacking tools that they used to find these and execute on them, and also basically anything that you can think of that would be able to break a different piece of technology. So in total, there's 8,761 documents and files that were taken from an isolated high-security network situated inside the CIA's Center for Cyber Intelligence in Langley, Virginia. Right now, it's expected that a government contractor is the source of the leak, but of course no one ever, WikiLeaks never says who it was, and we won't know until the CIA does make some kind of arrest on this, because, you know, releasing this is evidence of treason, I think, just because, you know, when you work for a three-letter agency like that, you are sworn to secrecy. But basically everything that the CIA had on this was leaked, and this is going to be the first of number of publications from WikiLeaks on this topic. They had malware that targets iPhone, Android, and various smart TVs. They also have malware that targets Windows, Mac OS, Linux, and various routers on the internet. And what you were talking about, rather than, you know, reporting vulnerabilities to Google, Microsoft, or Apple, when they were found, the CIA would hoard them and utilize them against its targets. Though, with that being said, both Apple and Google this week have said that most of what the CIA has published about their platforms has already been patched. So you can decide if you're going to believe Apple and Google and maybe Microsoft on this, or you can operate under the assumption that you're always potential to being hacked by the CIA if the CIA wants to put you on its target list. And I think that's what needs to be underscored here. Is that unless you're a target of them, you probably don't have to worry, right?
I mean, what I think that is, the CIA, I'm sure they do good work. Let's keep that first. And I'm sure that somebody thought that this was a good idea and that they are doing the best for their country, and I'm not an expert, so I'm not going to say whether they were wrong or right, but I think a lot of people are worried that there is no supervision on this at all. Like, nobody really knows what's going on there.
Yeah, and I think that's why it was done.
And nobody really knows what it means to be a target. Like, who decides whether they can just break into your stuff and take a look around? What is stopping them from preventively checking everybody's homes for, I don't know what's happening. Like, the point is, this is all not defined. Nobody knows what's happening there. And the people working at CIA are still human, so there are going to be mistakes, and there's going to be like bad judgments involved. And also, the mere existence of all these zero-day bugs and malware things, like, they were currently leaked to WikiLeaks, and WikiLeaks probably is not evil, so they just released that these things are there. But for the same, alternatively, these tools might come in hands of, like,
a bad actor.
Attackers.
Yeah.
Yeah, a bad actor that might start using these for things that the CIA could not even imagine. That's
right. And I think, you know, WikiLeaks said they did redact things where bad actors could have gained advantage from this, and they didn't publish full binaries of the actual hacking tools.
And they're also in conversation with the big tech companies to make sure that they can fix these problems. I mean, the problem is that this responsibility of informing the companies about these weaknesses, I think, should not lie with WikiLeaks. I think it should lie with the government. I think the government should fully try and protect their citizens. But I can see this being hard call, because, you can use it to get advantage over whoever you're trying to target. But you have to make the consideration that, do I put all the citizens at risk for this, because of this problem, security problem in this piece of operating system, or do I keep it so I can use it in these cases where I want to, and who knows, maybe save lives, right?
Yeah, and you know, case in point, San Bernardino iPhone. Apple didn't want to crack the phone. They had to go to a third party somewhere else. It was a 5C, so a little bit more crackable than the modern phones, but still, the government wanted Apple's help, and Apple wouldn't do that. So this is the same kind of question that was being raised there. Should tech companies and the government work hand in hand so that they inform each other of their vulnerabilities so that they can have a higher level of cooperation? Or should the companies just be up to, you know, protecting the privacy of their consumers?
I mean, I think it is in the tech company's best interest to protect their customers. That's what they do.
Oh, yeah,
that's what
absolutely.
The government, I mean, like, if you don't think too deeply about it, you want things to be safe. You want your privacy to be done. But there is this trade-off that is incredibly difficult. And I think this topic has been discussed so much, so I don't want to linger on it too much. But there's this double thing, like, to make sure that people can do observation and monitoring of targets, let's call them targets, you have to give him some privacy. If he locked everything down completely, would we be less safe? That is a question that has to be answered.
And I don't think we can answer that.
I don't know either. I mean, the question is how many things have actually been prevented by these tools.
Yeah, and we'll never
know.
That's
a statistic I would like to know, and I think that's just a statistic that should be found out by someone, and they should reconsider, like, what are the actual
benefits and metrics that we get off this.
Like, the trade-off between the two, like, is it actually worth it? Like, if there's just one thing, like how high do you value privacy,
right,
and how useful is it to not value the privacy high, and is the cost maybe too high?
And you
I don't know. I
think the gray area comes in here is because the CIA is designed to be the international spying ring of the U.S. The CIA is not supposed to spy on its own citizens. Anything that happens inside the U.S. is supposed to be handled by the FBI, which can ask for help from the NSA, National Security Agency, and CIA if they need it. But the CIA on its own is not supposed to spy on U.S. citizens. And because of all these products are evidently inside U.S. houses, that raises that question. And also, if you're a foreign resident of, say, Germany, for example, we know well, in fact, that the CIA has tapped the German chancellor before. So, you know, there's just one more thing here before we move on from this, I think, in relation to the smart TVs, quoting that the attack against the Samsung smart TVs was developed in cooperation with the UK's MI5 and BTSS. After infestation, Weeping Angel places the target TV in a fake off mode so that the owner falsely believes the TV is off when it is on. In fake off mode, the TV operates as a bug, recording conversations in the room and sending them over the internet to a covert CIA server.
Of course, it's named after a Doctor Who monster.
just like last week's RS Quest. They're also looking at infecting the vehicle control systems used by modern cars and trucks.
I mean, this is disturbing news, and I'm happy that, in a way, I'm happy that WikiLeaks gives insight in this, because I think maybe the biggest issue is not the actual spying. I think the biggest issue is that there's no supervision over this. There's no insight.
And, you know,
this.
That I think that's ultimately why they released it.
I think we need transparency on this. I think the CIA should just step up and say, yes, we are spying. That is the harsh truth, but we need that to guarantee your safety. But we have these protections in place to make sure that your privacy stays as well protected as possible. I think that is a responsibility that all the security agencies should take, and they have not taken that responsibility at all yet. And that's why we need things like WikiLeaks. But I'm really hoping that we can move to a point where there is a good equilibrium between everyone, and that there is not a construction like now where the CIA, FBI, and that kind of stuff can just sort of get away with things because nobody's really keeping tabs on them.
I think
no pun intended.
I think that is exactly where we need to go. And in closing on this, I'll just say that from the FAQ, isn't WikiLeaks worried that the CIA will act against its staff to stop the series? And the answer to that is no, that would certainly be counterproductive. So that means that if anything like that were to happen, the CIA would have a much bigger problem on its hands than they currently do. So that's worrying in its own. But before we go, what platform in the end do you think will end up being the most secure? Microsoft, Windows, Linux, or Mac, based on what the companies decide to do, or hell, even Android from Google?
Ooh, that's a tough one.
You know, conventional wisdom for me says it would be some distribution of Linux that's open source, and you can verify that the code that you're running on your Linux system is the code that's in the repositories. That way then everyone can see what's being run and that it's secure, isn't bugged, and can't be broken.
Mm-hmm.
That's what conventional wisdom tells me, but...
I mean, Android is also some sort of open platform. I think, like, the very, like, the base OS is also open source, so... Like, if it came to mobile operating systems, that would probably be the edge it has over iOS, which is really close.
Yeah.
So, definitely think that there is potential there.
Yeah.
In terms of, like, desktop, yeah, probably looking at a Linux distribution there, yeah.
And, you know, I think that next time Apple takes to the stage to do a product reveal and the question comes up about security, I think they will undoubtedly say, we are the company that you can trust to keep your data secure, because they were already on that bandwagon last September after the iPhone issue. So I bet they'll be continuing with that. Whether or not they actually are, I don't know. And like you said, all these companies have already said what has been leaked has been patched. So anyways, so just keep in mind, and we do have a link in the show notes to the WikiLeaks Vault 7 if you want to read for yourself of some of the stuff in there. There's some real humorous stuff in some of the pages that I found. So, alrighty. Next piece of tech news is that Snap tumbles for its first time since IPO after analysts say sell. So, as we all know, Snapchat's IPO came out not too long ago, and it has been in a tumble ever since it arrived. So, you know, Snapchat as an IPO always, you know, confounded me, because it's like, okay, so we have this application where you take a picture of yourself, send it to someone, and it disappears a few seconds later after the person views it. And yet this thing is, you know, being valued for more than Twitter is right now, which is absolutely insane.
I mean, I've used it. It was incredibly popular. I've never used it very intensively, but it creates a different kind of communication. And I think there is an interesting comparison to be made with Twitter, because when Twitter first came out, like, the whole idea of releasing something in only 140 characters was interesting, and you could do stuff with it, and but it never really grew into something. And Snapchat is sort of the same thing. Like, how do you add communication? Like, this is a new kind of communication where you can just, it is based on the sort of throwaway society we live in. Like, you make a picture, you send it, and that's it. Like, you don't store it. It's gone, which means you're a lot more likely to communicate using pictures and using visuals. So it's a new, I wouldn't say paradigm, but it's a new kind of communication that was added. And there's definitely some interesting things there. The whole point is they need to take it somewhere to keep it alive. Otherwise, it's going the same way as Twitter is going right
exactly.
now.
Exactly. You know, it was an opening price of $24. And, you know, the analysts looked at it and saw what was happening, and they realized that, you know, this is not going to be the price it's going to stay at. It's not going to go up. You know, the only reason Snapchat debuted for such a high price and why it was so hyped is because Snapchat is, in large part, nowadays, a household name, I think, you know, much like Twitter. And that is what generated the hype around it. But quoting from the article here, academic literature suggests that the sexier and more glamorous a company's IPO, the more likely it is to be overpriced at its IPO date and to suffer meaningful downwards earnings and valuations in the first 8 quarters after it goes public. So 8 quarters is 2 years. This was written by an analyst at Needham & Company in a note to Snapchat investors. She also said that Snap's actual value is probably more like $19 to $23 a share, and the company is still years away from profitability with a net loss higher than its revenue. That just gets me right there, is that we're trading this company that, you know, is having net losses that are higher than its revenue, yet it is being traded with, I mean, in any other, you know, traditional market of the past, that would just be insane. Like, you wouldn't be in business back then if your net revenue was, or if your net losses were larger than your net revenue. Like, it screams of some kind of bubble and some kind of thing that's broken with the markets in this whole regard. Like, right now in after hours trading, Snap is at 22.71. And, you know, it's been going down. It's down quite a bit. So we'll have to see where this goes. And at the end of the day, it's still worth more than Twitter, which, I mean, that it's just confounding. And I honestly don't think any of these companies have a real future, because Twitter tried the ad approach, and I think that's what Snapchat is going to do as well, unless, like you said, they can grow and become something else, which they haven't shown any indication of doing. So
I mean, I sort of stopped using it because just like I said, it's an interesting gimmick, and then like at some point it runs out, and I don't know.
Yeah, and I mean, I think the biggest thing that people are hoping will take off is the Snapchat stories, which are used by media installations to promote various news articles and whatnot, which, I mean, if you're going for that and you're charging people to appear on a featured Snapchat story, then maybe. But aside from that, I don't know.
But I've never looked at a featured story.
Yeah, same. I mean, like, looking on here right now, I don't think there's anything that would be remotely interesting to you or me. 20 words that only smart people use correctly. 10 proposal stories that will make you ugly cry.
This sounds like BuzzFeed.
Yeah, it certainly does. You ready for the next one?
Oh, dear.
Are condoms the best beauty hack? Others can do a trick that most people can't. These women will give you chills.
What?
Yeah, what? These are featured.
Oh my. Oh my. Why is Snapchat still a thing if that's the case?
IGN. Is this Netflix's worst Marvel show? I want to click on these one of these, but I'm not sure which one. I'm going to click on the smart word one. Okay, so then it goes into a thing of travesty is tragic or outrageous event. And then you can basically go to the next snap and see. So it's basically a way of interacting with articles that are graphical and whatnot. But, you know, with this, unless it's an ad, there's no way to make money out of the app right now, which, I don't know. I'm just going to put it down and move away, I think, right now. After
that sounds like a really good idea.
But see, that's what's on there, and I guess that's what sells. And you're right, it does sound like BuzzFeed. Anyone who knows me will know that I say BuzzFeed is garbage. So,
yeah, I agree with Shane here.
And that's why I stopped using Dig. Dig started being curated by BuzzFeed editors. All right, let's move on to the truly happy news of the week, and that is the Nintendo Switch's excellent sales numbers. So, apparently, the Switch launch sales in the Americas and Europe are Nintendo's best ever, you know, skipping past the Wii's and the N64 and the Super Mario for N64 as well. So, In a press release, it has been said that the company announced that its new hybrid console has sold more in its launch weekend than any other Nintendo hardware in history. Also added that The Legend of Zelda Breath of the Wild has become the biggest selling Nintendo launch title ever in Europe, even outselling Wii Sports in the first weekend sales. Adding, this success all came in March, a traditionally quiet month for the game industry. Again, Nintendo didn't include specific figures, and IGN has contacted them for further comment. In Japan, Nintendo Switch sold 313,000 units in its first 48 hours on sale, beating out the Wii U's 308,000 units in the same period prior. And of note, the PS4, when it was first released, sold 322,000 units during its first 2 days. So, Nintendo Switch seems to be doing well.
Yep. I think the launch title of Zelda is playing a big part of it. It's one of the most highly anticipated games for a long while, I think. And that's probably helping the sales numbers of the Switch. And I mean, this is the opening weekend. We'll have to see if it actually is going to beat the Wii in the long run. The console has been reviewed, and there are definitely some issues. Like, it doesn't really hold up in terms of hardware. The controls seem to be a bit uncomfortable. There seem to be connectivity issues with some of the Joy-Con controllers. Like, all in all, like, the quality of the console doesn't seem to be particularly good.
Yeah.
So, I if you look at the game consoles, like, Nintendo has now brought out, like, the Zelda game, which is more of a, I wouldn't call it a high-end game, but that's, like, a game you would just play on a console.
And it's very
yourself.
Traditional.
And it's very traditional. And then but Nintendo in general is really known for its party games, its original games. Like, think of Mario Party, Mario Kart, Splatoon.
Yeah,
those kind of games are generally what the games that thrive on Nintendo platforms. And the Nintendo Switch is a good product to serve those kind of games. The point is the Switch going to hold up for games like Zelda? Like, Zelda on the Switch has frame rate issues, which
that's not
is
good.
Surprising. It's bad. I mean, I think we can expect some updates to either the software on the Switch or the actual game software that might include optimizations. But if you start out with a game that is already not running smoothly on your console, then I think you really have to scratch behind your ears and think, is this really what we can do? And that is sort of what the problem I find with the Switch. Like, I really enjoy a lot of Nintendo's games. I'm a big Zelda fan myself. I like playing all the Zelda games. I have a Wii U at home. The point is, like, I don't see myself comfortably using a Switch.
Yeah.
Like,
and
you would use a Switch, I think, for something like having friends over and playing games together.
Sure.
But I don't think it can hold up, like, playing just games yourself. Like, for that, even the Wii and the Wii U already struggle in that genre. Like, you would be more likely to get a PS4 or an Xbox to play those games. And,
like, for me, I'm not immediately clear. Like, with a Switch, you can connect it to your TV, obviously, via an HDMI connection. But if you want to have other people play with you in a multiplayer setting, do you need, like, do you purchase more of the joystick controller things, or does everyone need to have their own Switch?
No, so the Switch comes with, like, two detachable controllers on the two sides. So you can play with two players off the bat, but you can also connect normal Pro controllers to it. That's more traditional controllers. So you can use those as well. And
where do you get these?
You have to buy them for, like, $60
and they're, or something. And they're specifically for the Switch, not backwards compatible with the Wii or anything.
Correct, yes. The Wii U has its own Pro controller. The Wii has its own Pro controller. Yeah.
Okay.
But yeah, people are saying, for example, if you want to play Zelda on the Switch, get a Pro controller. That's unmissable. So that's another I think it's £60. So it's probably like $80 that you have to pay on top of the console to comfortably play games. And even then, the frame rate just doesn't hold up. So
$69.99 US, the Pro Controller.
$70. Okay, yeah.
And the Joy-Cons are $80.
Okay, you can actually get those then. Yeah. So I think we are currently seeing the consequence of a hype, but I'm not entirely sure if we'll hold up the success. Like, it really is going to depend on whether it's going to really bring out those games that work well with the Switch, whether it can live up to the technical expectations that people have of games by now. And another factor that probably like helps the sales as well is that the Wii U has never been successful.
That's
so
right.
Let's be clear here
so we don't get lynched, is that the Wii U has been successful in a few games that people love to play, Smash and whatnot.
But like in terms of sales numbers, it hasn't been as successful. Right. Like it was supposed to be the success of the Wii, but in the sales never really took off. And that is probably the reason why we see the Switch relatively early in the cycle. Under all circumstances, we would have expected the Wii U to be the main console for like at least a year or two more. But instead, we saw like the Switch come relatively soon. So what I think is that we see a lot of people skipping the Wii U generation, coming directly from Wii to Switch, because that's actually
that would be what I would do if I was in the market for one of these, because you know there's a Wii and it still works for the games that we want to play on it, like you know the odd Mario Kart and whatnot. I think it's going to be interesting to see with the Switch what kind of Mario Kart games we get, what kind of Smash games we get, so, if there's a Pokemon game for it.
So what they're currently doing is there's going to be Mario Kart 8 Deluxe, which is basically going to be the Wii U version, including some DLC, probably some graphics updates, maybe some extra content. But like, it's basically going to be the same game repackaged. Splatoon 2 is going to come out for the Switch, which is, I mean, I think it's also going to be pretty much the same game as the original Splatoon, just repackaged to bring it to the Switch. So they're sort of moving the catalog from the Wii U to the Switch, like almost 1-1, because like the Wii U was never successful, and with this entire new audience on the Switch, it's sort of like easy money. That's
looking at the Switch, comparing it to the Wii U, it kind of looks as though that if you were designing the Wii U today, and it would pretty much be what the Switch is, because it's got that huge screen that you can play with, the multi-touch screen.
I don't think it uses like. So what the Wii U does really well in some games is that you use both screens as like separate screens.
Right. And I think that was a great feature of the Wii U. It really stresses some stuff that we haven't really seen in game design and software design for a long time.
Correct. And it works really well. So just to give you an example, like both Zelda The Wind Waker and Zelda Twilight Princess got HD versions on the Wii U, which is like a remastered version of games that originally came out for the GameCube. And they use the gamepad for inventory management, which makes the game so nice. Like, you don't have to go to a lot of menus. Like, the game is on your TV, but like all your inventory stuff is like right in front of you.
Right.
If you need
a primitive
item, you just drag and it's there, and it's really intuitive and nice. And the Switch can't do all that stuff, so it goes back to a more traditional gaming. Like, the only gimmick it has is like the different controllers you can detach and attach, and like the portability of it. But do you see yourself taking like the entire console with you to play it on like public transport or something?
Well, it's 6.2 inches. That's pretty big.
Like, apparently somebody, like a colleague of mine, actually saw somebody playing it on a London tube today. But I mean, I would feel incredibly silly carrying that thing around and playing it.
Yeah, it's like taking the first iPad around.
Yeah. So, like, why would you bring this bulky thing? Or you can also bring an iPad Air, for example, which is tiny and has probably more processing power. Like, it what does it really add? And I guess it's nice that like you can, like say when you're traveling, for example, like going on vacation,
you can
like,
have
in the
your
back
games
of the car,
that you have on
yeah,
your TV
you can, like,
in the back of the car.
Like you're playing a game, like you're playing your Zelda on at the couch, and your mom is like, "We have to go now." You just pick it up and continue in the car. Like, sure, that's fun, but it also feels not revolutionary, not unique enough, and not enough to carry the console to the success that the Wii was. So, I mean, I'm happy that the launch is so good, but I am still pessimistic about where Nintendo is going. Like, there's people now that are really optimistic because of this, but I mean, arguably, they did a great job with Breath of the Wild. They did a decent job with the Switch, but like
they're getting
the console...
FIFA 18.
Oh wow!
Farming Simulator 18 as well.
I just a colleague of mine, like I'm gonna quote another colleague of mine that said, "Just looking at the Switch makes my wrists hurt of RSI."
Yeah,
and that sort of feels true. It doesn't sound like the platform of choice for me, and the only reason I would maybe end up getting it is because of some of the Nintendo originals on it.
Yeah.
But even then, like,
apparently there is a Pokemon game that's going to be arriving on the Switch at some time. It doesn't have a title yet or a release date, but there will be a Pokemon game for the Switch exclusively. That is not 3DS. So that'll be interesting to see if that drives too much, because you remember how much sales last summer Pokemon Go drove. So, You know, I agree with you. I wanted to like the Switch when it came out, and I think that it's an interesting way of doing it, but you're right. It feels less intuitive and less innovative than the Wii U did based on that. So,
I mean, if it was a solid device that worked well, that felt solid in your hands, I would probably have given it a chance. But like the reviews I read, it feels fragile because of all the detachable parts. Like, it has connectivity issues. Like, it doesn't feel well to play with. Like, it's sort of awkward. And then, like, all these things together, it's like, if you want to do something like this, you have to do it really, really well. And it sort of feels like a whole finished product. It feels like one of these concept things that has not really been worked out. And
you know, that's what Nintendo has gone for the past few releases.
I mean, if it was a tablet with like a quick, let's say this was something like a phone or a tablet with like a quicker cycle, where like next year we would get a new generation of that was better, that might work. But this is going to be the console. That's going to be the thing to get from Nintendo the next few years. Like, unless they're going to do something like the 3DS where they release a new 3DS.
Yeah, they could do that.
It's going to be the status quo of Nintendo.
And also remember that companies like Microsoft and Sony have also been going towards yearly or every 18 months so releases of their consoles. So it's not unfeasible. We could see Nintendo do the same thing, because we had the Xbox One S, and then we got Scorpio coming later this year as well, which will be a completely revamped Xbox One with all the backwards compatibility and a much powerful processor. So...
And maybe that is the way that Nintendo can maybe sort of, I don't want to say salvage, because obviously it has been successful, but if they want to like really put this to like a really successful product, I think they have to iterate on this and maybe bring out a revision that solves all these issues and makes it a more solid device. And that I would probably get. But in its current state,
You can get a 3DS for $100 less.
Yeah. And so. I have a 3DS at home. It's a great device, and there's fun games on it. And that's something I'm comfortable playing around, like taking around and playing on, because you can put it in your back pocket.
Yep. And it's got all the classic games. I know I was in the Best Buy recently and ended up taking a cruise through the gaming section. Don't normally do that. And there was all the games for 3DS. It's like, oh, these are, you know, classic Nintendo games. And if we have all these on there, what is going to be the point of 3DS? You know, I should play one of these new Pokemon games one day. I haven't played one of those since Yellow. See what they're all like these days.
So I have a confession to make.
Okay.
I never really played a Pokemon game.
Eh, that's fine. Oh, yeah. And I see they're still the same price as they always used to be, $40 for a cartridge game.
Yeah, that's the thing with Nintendo games. They never drop in price.
Oh.
Hardly.
All right. Anything else on the Switch before we move on?
Probably, but like, let's leave it at this.
Okay, I'll just close off by saying that since you're in the UK, it's estimated that the Switch sold 80,000 units across the UK in its opening weekend.
That sounds like not a lot, actually.
Well, it's apparently double the number of Wii U consoles that sold in the same period.
Hmm.
So, we'll have to wait and see for Nintendo quarterly results and see what that's doing for profits. And then if it is indeed helping Nintendo be profitable and stay profitable, then you can expect further development on the product, I guess. But anyways, we do have our Skill of the Month update for March, the Thieving Skill of the Month. Currently, Jamandy52 is currently in first place with 22.4 million XP gain. Then it's a long way down to second with Undoer at 5.6 and Parnassius at 5.1, rounding out the top three in the thieving skill of the month.
I mean, this can of course change because thieving can go really fast, but it looks like this is going to end up being a race for second place.
Yeah, and you know, this is why sometimes we ask ourselves, should we make the RSBNB skill competitions once every 14 days to see how that goes? I mean, we could do that. Like, there's nothing to prevent this system we have from running every 14 days or every 7 days. It's just we do it every month because that's the way it's been done. So, and I mean, given how fast XP grows in RS, that might be something we look at. So, I don't know. All right. In accordance with that, we do have a good number of achievements of the week. Okay. So starting on March 8th, Wolfie got 99 Thieving and Simbakuro got 99 Herblore. On the 7th, Tosol 798 got 99 Strength and Mizu Arashi got 120 Invention. Now on March 6th, Takas Fugo got 99 Defense and 99 Magic. Then jumping on down to March 5th, we got a whole boatload of them on March 5th, so much so that Sirion and I are going to split them apart here. Wolfie got 99 Herblore, Xenon, 99 Farming, Antivistic, 99 Woodcutting, Giovannig, 99 Dungeoneering, and Wolfie, 99 Prayer.
All right, I'll continue with the last three of them on March 5th then. Brabhack got 120 Dungeoneering, Sirapyro got 99 Herblore, and Giovanni got 99 Divination. Then March 4 is a bit more quiet. We have Zookeeper 53 getting 99 Fletching, Wolfie getting 99 Summoning, and Goku SSJ4 getting 99 Divination. Then March 3, we only have Wolfie getting 99 Ranged. And finally, on March 2, we have Patapolo getting 99 Mining, Tosol 798 getting 99 Defense, and Feel My Pokes getting 99 Fletching. Congratulations, all. That's some nice achievements in there.
Good job, everyone. That's more than I could ever get. All right. So, Pick of the Week. Pick of the Week isn't going to be a surprise, given what we just talked about for the past half hour. So, take it away.
Yeah, I have to pick Zelda Breath of the Wild as Pick of the Week.
And you're playing it on Wii U, right?
I am playing it on Wii U because I mean, like I said, the Switch, I'm not convinced. And I decided to just get the Wii U copy, play it on that. There's, like, the game is completely the same. Like, it's completely the same. The graphics on the Switch are better, but yeah, I'll talk about that in a bit. But the games being exactly the same is pretty much the only weak point of it. Because as we just talked about, the Wii U has this gamepad, which is sort of a tablet, which is also your controller. And then the actual game is actually on the TV. And often games use both screens, so you can use the touch screen to, like, for example, manage your inventory. Because Breath of the Wild is, like, completely the same on both consoles, it doesn't use the gamepad at all. It actually has a really annoying fading in and fading out message that explains that you can tap the screen to play on your gamepad, but that's all it does.
What? Which, wow.
Yeah.
So it seems like it was designed as a Switch-first product then.
It seems that way, yeah. I mean, it was developed original for the Wii U. Like, it was in development before the Switch was even, like, considered and made. So clearly it sort of moved towards this shared thing, and that is probably why it doesn't have any Wii U specific functionality, but that also is a bit of a weakness of the game because it doesn't really utilize the console to its fullest. And but then there is the point of the graphics. So Zelda Breath of the Wild is absolutely gorgeous if you look at stills. So, and this is where the problem comes in. So the Wii U is, I mean, it's a couple of years old by now, but they still managed to get a lot out of it. It's just not uncommon to see some serious frame drops happening. And it's not uncommon to have that on the Wii U in general, but it sort of takes away from that experience, and it is to be expected if you get a game at the end of a console lifetime that was also created for a console that's the next generation. But then we look at the Switch version and it has the exact same issue. So you can play the game both in handheld mode, which is you play it like on the tablet setup of the Switch, where you play in 720p, in which it runs relatively fine, and then when you dock the console and play it on your TV, it actually scales up to 900p, and that's when the trouble starts, and that's when the console just can't handle it and has serious problems with frame drops. Add to that the connectivity issues with the Joy-Con and that kind of stuff, and that experience is not great either. So while the game itself is really, really solid, I'm really enjoying playing it. It's very different from the previous games. It's completely open world. It has many RPG elements. The controls have been changed quite a lot. You can now, like, jump yourself, for example, instead of the very characteristic of automatic jumping when you run towards an edge. So the game has changed a lot. They have completely gone back to their roots of the original Zelda, and the actual game itself feels pretty solid. There's still a few things I have to get used to. I only played for a few hours up to now, but all in all, it is a very enjoyable experience. It's just because this split between consoles, it seems that it sort of has become not entirely perfect for either of them. And you get these, I don't know, limitations that you run into, and these frame drops just take away from the experience. And
you have to see if there's a software update that'll arrive for that.
Yeah, so there was a day one patch that apparently solved a lot of the issues already, but it's still just not great. And while I do expect that the Switch version will probably get some software updates, I'm slightly pessimistic about what the support will be on the Wii U, given that it's sort of the previous generation console.
Yeah. And they'll so we have to be driving see about people to the Switch.
I mean, we have also to consider it's like it's not a PC game, which is very common to get updates for that. Like, console games are a lot more often just they're released and they might get a day one patch and that's it. So
yep,
we'll have to see where it goes. So far, it's a pretty enjoyable experience. I'm just sad that it doesn't seem to show its full potential on either console. Then again, it was announced that it is the game that got the most perfect reviews ever on Metacritic. It is received incredibly high. It gets very, very high scores in all the reviews. So as I said, the actual game is really, really good, but I don't think it warrants a perfect score. just because there are all these loose ends on either version. And
you've got 98 on Metacritic.
That's really, really, really high. That's really high. So yeah, I mean, it was sort of rushed to get it in as a launch title for the Switch, but
7.6 user score though.
Hmm.
So a bit down on that, but
yeah.
Well, I mean, I think you hit the nail on the head. From what it sounds like, it's a pretty good game, minus a few little issues. And if you play it on the Wii or the Switch, or the Wii U or the Switch, you're going to have a good experience. It's going to maybe vary a bit if you're on the Wii U, right?
I mean, it's going to vary on the Switch as well. It's just, like, it was not... I mean, it doesn't really utilize the uniqueness and the features of either of them. It's just, it's a very generic game in that case. Like, you could play this game on any console. It doesn't utilize any of Nintendo's uniqueness. That's what
that's unfortunate.
Could have made it stronger. Yes. Like, the older Zelda games, like, if you go back to Ocarina of Time, I mean, that you could play that on, like, any console as well if you want to. But, like, especially the recent ones, like the handheld ones and the HD remasters, they were really tailored to their console. That is what made them so good. But I mean, arguably Skyward Sword on the Wii was also tailored to motion controls, which made it bad. But that could have been done more, and it feels rushed and incomplete, which takes away from the experience a bit. But on the other hand, like, it has been a very, very long while since we got a big Zelda release like this one, and it lives up to all the hype that had been created. So nevertheless, I'll pick it, and I'll probably spend many, many hours playing it nevertheless.
Well, there you go. That's Legend of Zelda Breath of the Wild, probably something a lot of people have been waiting a long time for to come out. A good old classic Nintendo game.
I mean, if you ever only played the original Zelda, this is basically that. Like, it's really back to its root. It's completely open world. You're just thrown in, and it's just the same old 8-bit game, sort of, but with all your modern game development helper tools, so that you get, like, a bit more directed to what you have to do and where you have to go. But it's... like, you can completely ignore that and go in the other direction. Like, I have heard that it's possible to get to the final boss in, like, 15 minutes if you want to.
What?
So,
wow.
This is, yeah, it's like, you have to be really, really good because it's, but you sort of have to become better. And the way you do it is completely open to yourself. So,
well, that's good. And I think that in itself really highlights what we can expect from a Nintendo game. So that's good.
Mm-hmm.
I'm happy with that. Excellent pick of the week. What have you been up to this week on RS?
Well, not a lot because I've been playing Zelda.
All right.
I've been doing a few dailies, but I'm still just hanging just below the 99 invention mark. So I should probably pick a date to just finish it off, have a bit of celebration.
Do it.
Then we'll see what I do afterwards. I have a few goals. I want to probably get 120 Dungeoneering. I want to get Taskmaster. I might go for the Master Quest Cape or something, but
that wouldn't be very nice. I like the Master Quest Cape. I think that'd be a good thing for you to do.
Mm-hmm.
All right. As for me on RS, I came up with a new herb lore strategy, which I've begun to employ. Initially, I had thought, oh, let's just farm the Snape Grass as well, but then I realized, oh, Snape Grass is 17 GP each on the Grand Exchange. We can buy that up 1,000 at a time, no problem. So I am actually farming Ranner herbs and making the prayer potions with that, because the secondary is easy to get. Then those are going to get combined with the prayer renewals to make the super prayer renewal combination potions, which are sellable on the exchange. So, you know, hopefully over time I'll be able to control the entire market on that and, you know, set prices and control where people are going to buy those from. So that'd be nice. Though I don't know if that'll happen. That would be in an ideal world, of course. But that is the current herbalar strategy. But aside from that, just a few dailies here and there. Going to try and do some daily challenges this weekend to try and get those pieces for the elite wood cutting outfit, and hopefully be able to get 5 of them in total, and then trade around to try and complete a set just so I have one, and then wait for the next, you know, probably 6 to 8 months until it appears in game as a unlock to complete the rest. So, and you know, I really don't think this one's overpowered, so that's why I have no problem trying to go for it.
Sounds good.
Yeah. But not too much else. I did do an Informer article this week, which you can find at informer.rsbnb.com, talks about the capabilities of a modern web browser. Did you guys know that modern web browsers have the ability to access the battery API or access the battery data inside a device if the browser is modern enough? Or that browsers on the mobile phones can access the accelerometers and gyroscopes? And all in all, that is slowly pushing us towards a world where we can do applications that feel native inside a browser. So lots of interesting things that can come from that, and some recommended web apps to have a look at the end of that everyone uses.
It is sort of my job to keep up with these things, so I was aware of that. But
yeah,
like it's really, really awesome, and I'm hoping that that they're going to be used for good.
Yeah, you know, I think the idea of being able to, you know, completely bypass an app store and just charge whatever you want for your service and run it through a web browser is where we want it to be when the iPhone came out, and I think we're finally just getting there. And Apple actually appears to be the stumbling block these days for running those kind of things on the browser. So, yeah, definitely very interesting. If you are not aware of what browsers can do, give this a read. So, I don't believe there's anything else to go for this week, unless you have anything.
No, I'm all good.
Alrighty then. Well, we will see you guys next week, and thank you for sharing your time with us.
Bye.